Good morning, everyone. Another beautiful day to look at connections. And for those of you who are visiting this morning, connections is the theme for our summer services, however each speaker wants to understand or interpret this word. For me, because of my own personal experience, I chose the title War Connections, An American Heart in Russia. But I am not alone here. Several of our church members also now have, or in the past have had, close connections with Russia or Ukraine, and have happy memories of people in each country. Therefore, some of our hearts are aching. For me, during the first few weeks of the Russian invasion, I started having flashbacks, remembering the kind Russian mothers who had befriended me in the 9 months I lived in the Soviet Union. The year was 1975, and I was living in Moscow in a very large, all-Russian building in an all-Russian neighborhood. My daughter was then 2 years old, and her father was part of a science exchange program at the Kurchatov Institute of Atomic Energy Research. We were very warmly welcomed by the Soviet government because Soviet scientists wanted their physicists inside our American atomic energy facilities. At that time, I had already studied Russian, so I could get around the city comfortably and also converse with our neighbors. After the first few weeks of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we heard reports of heavy Russian casualties. 15,000 Russian soldiers were thought to have been killed. I could not help then but think of these mothers whose little boys, Ivan and Nikolai, had played with my little girl. Ivan was 3 years old, and I remember one day, quite by surprise, when he appeared with a large metal rifle hanging from his neck and across his little chest. I stared in horror, thinking, I hope this little boy will not grow up to kill my little girl. And I don't want my little girl to grow up and kill this little boy. Ivan's mother saw my look of distress and said ruefully, his uncle gave it to him. I nodded, realizing that she wasn't happy with this rifle either. And so in February, I thought of the Russian mothers and their little boys and wondered if they were okay. Ivan would now be 50, and little Nikolai, who was a baby, would now be 48. And I wondered if they were fighting in Ukraine, or did they possibly even themselves now have grown sons who are fighting there and maybe dying. There's no way for me to know because we mothers never kept in touch. When I was leaving to go back to the States, I never suggested that we correspond for their safety, and they never suggested it either. This past March here in the States, we started to get reports of food shortages in Russia, and my heart sank as I had flashbacks of my own struggles to find nourishing food for our family in 1975. We could always buy staples, bread, potatoes, cabbage, beets, and onions. bread, potatoes, cabbage, beets, and onions, and more bread, potatoes, cabbage, beets, and onions, always available. But most solid protein was missing. There were eggs, but never in 9 months did I see chicken for sale, or protein substitutes like seeds or nuts. Only 3 times was there any hamburger for sale. Usually there were ample supplies of sausage, long tubes of sausage, embedded always with chunks, large chunks of white fat. I remember the chunks being as big as dice, but whatever. And I never could face buying this. And fruit was scarce. Once I was walking to the store to buy bread, and I noticed a woman standing very quietly and still up against an empty shack. Moscow had many of these empty shacks all over the city. But occasionally a truckload of something special would arrive, a scale would be set up, and the shack would become a little store. So on this day my antenna went up, I looked around and realized that behind the shack was a very large truck. The back was open and it was jammed with bananas. I grabbed my daughter and ran to be right behind that woman. Within half a minute, there must have been at least 30 people in line. As the bananas were being unloaded and sold, people bought as many as they could carry. I got 28 bananas and ran home. In front of our building were 4 little girls who had been nice to my daughter, so I immediately gave a banana to each one. The younger 3 peeled their bananas and ate them. But the older one knew the drill. She looked carefully at the banana and then asked, "Where did you get these?" I replied, "Oktoberskoye Polya," meaning the Oktoberskoye metro station. Okay. Later, I learned that she immediately ran up to her apartment, screamed to her mother, "Bananas at Oktoberskoye Polya." Her mother grabbed her purse, and the 2 of them ran 6 blocks to the metro station. But by the time they got there, the bananas were gone. In case you're wondering what I did with 24 other bananas, I can tell you, no problem. I took them around to neighbors who had been helpful to us. For instance, one neighbor once brought strawberries to us. So with reports of food shortages now, I wonder, are the Russian people going to have to go back in time to relive this struggle to get healthy food? In addition to the struggles to buy food, basic goods like clothes, shoes, winter gloves could be hard to find. I remember once being on an outing with a grandmother with whom I had become friends and her little grandson, Anton. On this outing, Anton somehow managed to lose one of his gloves. And do remember, Moscow winters can go way below 0. This grandmother and I searched and searched and searched until she was almost crying. Not because of money. I knew she had plenty of money. But I wasn't sure that she would be able to find another pair of gloves to buy for Anton. Luckily, good news, we did eventually somehow find that glove. In 1975, this problem of lack of goods was true even in the physics laboratories. In the physics lab where my daughter's father worked, there were four oscilloscopes. These instruments are important to measure changes in electrical current. In this institute lab, the four oscilloscopes all worked sort of, but not exactly. Something was off kilter with each one. This meant the scientists, when doing their experiments, had to remember to make adjustments in their calculations according to the particular problem of the instrument on which they were working. And the laboratory had no screwdrivers, so that when a screw came loose, they simply got out a nail file to tighten the screw. Well, there's something else that troubles me now, in addition to the shortage of food and goods. This past May, we began hearing stories from foreign journalists of the Russian people themselves saying they're afraid to talk because of the police on the streets and the arrests. Once more, these stories took me back to Moscow in 1975. The neighbors then didn't talk about police or arrests ever. Never. At least to me. But the fear was obvious. Often I talk about the United States and some of our challenges, mentioning as one example the exorbitant cost for a good college education. And the Russian neighbors were always very sympathetic, because Russian education was basically free through the university level, a real plus for the Soviet Union. However, my neighbors never once ever criticized the government. The closest they came was to lament the air in Moscow, saying it was dirty. Dirty air. Okay. Actually, not realizing how fearful people were, I kept making one serious mistake, frequently offering to introduce one of my neighbors to another. For example, "Oh, you're studying English? Did you know there's another woman in our building who is also studying English? Would you like to meet her?" And the curt, stony response was always, "Nyet," meaning no. This confused me until finally learning that a non-Russian was never supposed to introduce one Russian to another because of possibly endangering one of them if the other one belonged to the secret police. To digress a moment, some important history. When the Soviet Union broke apart in 1991, Russia continued to be a dictatorship, yes. But there was much more freedom to speak, and the people got used to this, and liked it, and wanted it. However, with this Russian invasion in Ukraine, things seem to have changed dramatically. And Russians again are experiencing mass arrests or are suddenly disappearing after publicly objecting to the invasion of Ukraine. Now I worry the people will once again have to live in terrible fear of their government. Today, the news reports are focusing, as they should, on the horrors perpetrated on the Ukrainian people. And actually, probably all of our hearts are aching for them, every single day. As these Ukrainian people continue to experience the destruction of their motherland and the loss of loved ones. At the same time, my heart is also with the Russian families back home who are also losing cherished family members. And there is something more. My concern for the welfare of the Russian soldiers themselves, wanting them to be spared a lifelong nightmare. This nightmare was vividly described by former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in his message to these Russian soldiers. Probably some of you heard his plea on YouTube. If not, you can Google it to hear his entire message. It's very powerful. Schwarzenegger described the violence he himself and many other Austrian children experienced from their fathers after these men returned home from the Second World War. These fathers had been proud Nazis who had fought heroically. So they thought. But after the war, they had to deal with the ugly truth that they had been lied to by their Nazi superiors. At least some of these men, for the rest of their lives, had to struggle with memories of atrocities which they had visited upon innocent people. Everyone has heard about the Nazi concentration camps, but there was so much more. Like the 2-year siege of Leningrad, where an estimated 800,000 Russian men, women, and children literally starved to death. Schwarzenegger's father was one of the Nazis who perpetrated this atrocity. And so I worry about what will happen to these Russian soldiers and am concerned for the safety of their wives and children when these husbands and fathers return home one day and have to face the truth of their actions in Ukraine. The current Russian generals and battalion chiefs are something else. The ones making the decisions for the soldiers under them, decisions for which these underlings may or may not have a choice. These generals and battalion chiefs must one day be held accountable, every single one of them. As well as the soldiers who gladly participated in the horrifying brutality against Ukrainian people. Because of all the Russian people I met in 9 months, and amidst all this terror in Ukraine and the wars dragging on, I'm concerned that some Americans will start to think of the Russian people as evil. This apprehension is not so far-fetched as it may sound. Some of us who are older remember vividly the 1950s Big Red Scare, with our own government's vilification of the Soviet Union and then the Russian people. Some of us remember that Americans who sympathized with communism, meaning the Soviet Union, were literally in danger of losing their jobs, and some of them did lose their jobs. Bad Soviet Union, suggesting bad Russian people who supported this terrible government. I was a teenager then and remembered all this and believed it. But my experience in 1975 belied this U.S. government hysteria, and I hope we will not return to it. Instead, let's celebrate the Russian people who are out on the streets demonstrating and speaking up publicly against the invasion and risking arrest or worse, And may we always remember, most Russian people are pretty much like people all over the world, just trying to put food on the table, occasionally longing for some bananas or strawberries, hoping to have warm winter gloves for the little ones, and in the laboratories, maybe even a screwdriver or an oscilloscope that really works. So may it be.